Committee is open. Good morning, everyone. First, some committee business. We're going to open up with a work session for purposes of introducing legislative drafts.
Mr. Chair, I move that LCs 4080 dated 3/9/15 and 4081 dated 3/9/15 be introduced as committee bills, and then I'll speak to my motion.
Senator Boquist moves that LCs 4080 and 4081 be introduced as committee bills. Senator Boquist?
Just the typical statement, introduction of these LCs isn't a reflection of any member of the committee's position on any of the LCs, simply brings them into play so we can have informed discussion amongst us in a nice bipartisan manner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And these are two potential bills for tax reform and trying to clean up our tax system. Further discussion? Seeing none. Objections? Seeing none. These LCs will be sent down to turn into legislation. And now I'd like to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 14. Kyle?
Why, Kyle, do you always bring interesting bills?
I think the question is, why am I always assigned interesting bills? Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. SB 14, what it would do is it would remove the prohibition against local government's imposition of taxes on cigarettes and other tobacco products, and it would apply to cigarettes and other tobacco products distributed on or after the effective date of this act.
Senator Rod Monroe is here as one of the chief sponsors.
Rod Monroe, Senate District 24. Thank you for hearing this bill. Mr. Chair, I appreciate it. This bill is as introduced with the support of the counties of this state and also many of the cities. We require counties to provide a lot of mental health and human resource needs for their citizens, also to provide transportation needs for their citizens. But we tie their hands in that we say, if you want to put a nickel on the cigarette tax to help pay for some of these things, you can't do that. And yet, especially in the northern counties, well, in southern counties, too, because cigarette taxes in California and especially in Washington are much higher than in Oregon. So what we have is a lot of folks from Washington and from California coming across the border to buy their tobacco products because they're much cheaper. Now, if the local governments, counties in particular, had the ability to tack a little surcharge on to meet some of the human resource and transportation needs of their people, I think that would be a good thing. When we give responsibilities to the local governments, we ought to also free their hands when it comes to raising the necessary revenue to meet those responsibilities. This measure, Senate Bill 14, does not raise any taxes and, in fact, does not require a three-fifths majority because it doesn't raise taxes. It simply removes the prohibition, the current prohibition that counties are hampered with in terms of their opportunity to tack a few pennies on to meet some of their needs. You may know that 2 cents of the state cigarette tax goes to elderly and handicapped transportation. Well, elderly and handicapped transportation is an increasing need as our population ages. Senator Riley and I are very aware of this. And yet, there's a declining revenue source, and so we're having a hard time meeting the transportation needs of elderly and handicapped. That's just one of the needs that a county might want to meet with a small penny or two on top of the state cigarette tax. I would hope that you would move this measure after hearing from my friends in the at the counties, and there's supposed to be a couple of them here to testify. I would hope that you would move this forward and let us have an opportunity to vote on it in the full Senate and then get it over to the House. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for Senator Monroe? Thank you, sir. I know you're chairing the subcommittee down the hall, so we'll let you retire.
Yeah, my co-chair, Betty Comp, is chairing for me right now, but I've got to head on down there. Thank you very much once again.
Thank you. Tricia Tillman from Multnomah County.
Good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee. I'm here today. My name is Tricia Tillman, and I'm the Director of Public Health for the Multnomah County Health Department. And I'm here today to express my support for Senate Bill 14, which removes the current preemption against local government imposition of taxes on cigarettes and tobacco products. As Director for Public Health, I have a vested interest in serving and protecting our community. As a mother of teens and a public health leader to the health department, I'm dedicated to promoting health and wellness and reducing health disparities in the many communities I serve. Tobacco use remains the leading cause of preventable death in this country. In Multnomah County alone, almost 1,200 people die from tobacco use annually. Furthermore, $223 million is spent each year on medical care for tobacco-related illness. Another $196 million, almost, in productivity is lost due to tobacco-related illness and early death. Nearly 90% of all adult smokers begin before the age of 18. And we know that price makes a difference, especially in discouraging young people from starting. As stated in the Surgeon General's report, raising tobacco product prices decreases tobacco use, particularly among youth and young adults. And I know this price is something that my teenagers are very sensitive to as they manage their little budgets. The report concludes that raising tobacco taxes is one of the most effective tobacco prevention and control strategies. Reducing use and exposure to tobacco is an issue of health equity. Tobacco products are unfairly and disproportionately marketed and sold in low-income communities and communities of color, which in turn hurts our neighbors, friends, and families by causing chronic health problems and premature death. Studies confirm that tobacco industry differentially appeals to people with the lowest income and education through point-of-sale advertising, and there is more advertising in racially diverse and low-income neighborhoods. For example, marketing to Hispanics and American Indians and Alaska Natives has included advertising and promotion of cigarette brands with names such as Rio, Dorado, and American Spirit. Additionally, menthol cigarettes are more likely to be marketed in stores near schools with a higher proportion of African-American students. Furthermore, tobacco companies promote specific brands to lesbian, gay, bisexual populations through outdoor advertising, ads in gay-oriented magazines, nightclub promotions, and event sponsorships. And the Multnomah County Health Department supports statewide policies to reduce disparities, particularly within diverse communities. Counties across Oregon, including Multnomah County, face the challenge of increasing public health costs and the growing needs for additional services. And lifting preemption would provide another tool for our leaders to use for a population reach and impact while addressing the disproportionate burden of disease caused by tobacco. Communities are in crisis, and we need to be able to consider all tools necessary to raise resources to meet local needs and address our critical health disparities. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on this very important bill before you today.
Thank you, Tricia. Questions from Multnomah County? Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you proposing to raise taxes to fund health care, or are you proposing to raise them to deter tobacco use and use that money to educate people on the bad effects of smoking?
Thank you for your question, Chair Hass. The research shows that raising funds alone is a deterrent to tobacco use, particularly among youth. So that is in itself a prevention strategy. But the additional funds could be used, if that was a direction that local counties decided to go in, could be used additionally for prevention. And I don't know if there are plans at the local county level at this point for investing those funds in prevention or in treatment and cessation, but those are strategies that are also effective.
Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
Just a clarification since you're up here. The sponsor made mention of the example of raising the tax to use it for county transportation funds. I think what I'm hearing you saying that that's probably not a good idea if you're going to raise it for either one, tax reduces, or two, use the revenues for funds related to health care. Is that what I'm hearing you saying, or are you on board with let's raise the tax so that we can spend it on transportation?
Chair Hass, members of the committee, thank you for your question. I can't comment on the comments made by the senator prior to me. So I don't know.
Follow up?
Yeah.
Senator Boquist.
More specific, does Multnomah County want to raise the tax to reduce utilization or use of the cigarettes and assist in mental health and other issues related to tobaccos, or does Multnomah County want to raise the tax to spend elsewhere?
So my preference, and again, this is a local county conversation which we haven't had, but my preference would be to use the funds to support prevention efforts directed towards tobacco use.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate the answer, too. Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Matt Evans.
Thank you, Chair Hass, members of the committee. My name is Matt Evans. I'm from Raleigh Hills, Oregon. I'm here this morning representing the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. We want to urge a no vote on SB 14 for a variety of reasons, which I'll briefly go over. The Oregon legislature has previously considered opening up the opportunity for local governments to tack on additional cigarette tax, tobacco tax, and has soundly rejected the idea. As far as I know, it's never even come to a vote on the floor of either body. And they've done that, I think, wisely. This is not a good idea. One of the things we don't want in this state is for the legislature to create some kind of a crazy quilt of a tax system where there's no reliability or understandability for businesses and individuals. What businesses want in taxation is predictability. And if you're a statewide small business, for example, that runs a chain of convenience stores around the state, and the tax rate for cigarettes might be different for a store in Multnomah County versus Washington County, you're giving a burden to that business that's just unnecessary, frankly. And as we all know, businesses don't pay taxes. They simply pass them on to someone. They may raise the prices on their customers. They may lower the pay and benefits of their employees. But somehow that money comes from somebody else. So all we're doing is raising somebody else's taxes in something like this. I think it's obvious that we're not talking about every county in Oregon taking this on. We're talking about the larger counties. As Senator Monroe was kind enough to point out, some areas of Oregon, like the Portland metropolitan area and some places in southern Oregon, currently enjoy an advantage in this area because the tax rate on cigarettes in Oregon is lower. So we actually get people coming from Washington State or California to purchase tobacco products in the state of Oregon. if you raise the tax in Multnomah County, you take away that advantage. And the people that are currently coming from Washington and spending their money here and paying Oregon taxes stop doing that. The net result of this is less tax revenue for the, let's say, for example, Multnomah County were to pass a nickel a pack tax and people from Washington stopped coming to Multnomah County. The net result is the state of Oregon gets less cigarette tax revenue and Multnomah County gets more cigarette tax revenue. Really, your concern should be state revenue, not local revenue. Finally, and I think this goes back to the question that Senator Boquist asked the previous witness. Cigarette taxes are easy, right? You've got addicts. People can't stop smoking. It's easy to put additional taxes on them and simply use it as a catch-all. We already, at the state level, use it as a catch-all for senior transportation. We send money back to the cities and counties with no strings attached that just fill up their general funds. There's no prohibition on how these dollars are spent. It's important that tax revenue have relevance to what we're trying to get accomplished. We can't use cigarette taxes as a catch-all for senior transportation or other non-relevant healthcare needs, needs not relevant to healthcare. So the Taxpayer Association, for these reasons, urges you to provide a no vote on SB 14. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your testimony. I would like to call up Stacy Michelson and Andy Smith from the AOC in the city of Portland. In the meantime, Kyle, can you refresh us on what the state tax is now on tobacco and what it is in Washington State?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So we have a chart. It's in the basic facts document that we talked about back at the start of the session, but it lists all the 50 states. So we can get that added to OLIS. Later on, but yeah, the difference between the for the cigarette taxes, at least between I guess our neighbors to the north, there's excise tax and there's sales tax. So Oregon doesn't have a sales tax. So if you're comparing the excise tax in Washington, it'd be at $3.03 per pack, compared to Oregon, which is at $1.31. And then Washington, when you add in the sales tax per pack of cigarettes, it'd be $3.53 compared to the $1.31, so it's a difference of $2.22 between the two states.
Okay, help me in English now. Show me the number.
Washington is 303 and Oregon's is 131.
Washington is 303 tax.
And what about California?
And Oregon's
$1.31.
Okay.
California, let me find that. California is, their excise tax is 87 cents, with their sales tax per pack would be at 41 cents. So they're right pretty near Oregon's tax. And then Idaho's a little bit lower at about 86 cents combined per pack.
And in the basic facts booklet that you all have on the desktop of your computer, like me, it's on page J3. In a paging system that only the LRO could come up with.
Right.
J3.
Go ahead. Idaho is 86 combined, yeah.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Stacy Michelson, policy manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 14. Senator Moreno mentioned counties are very supportive of this issue, I think for a number of the reasons that he highlighted. I think the conversation around county budgets is nothing new, right? As many of you know, a number of our local governments are regularly strapped, trying to balance budgets between public safety, public health, figuring out how to meet the needs of their local communities. What you may or may not realize is statutorily, our counties and our county boards actually serve as both the local public health authority and the local mental health authority. Particularly on the public health side, that is one of the reasons why we are very supportive of this issue. Through the task force on the future of public health services work, came out a number of folks, I think, were very surprised to find that nationally, Oregon ranks 46th in our per capita funding for public health. We're actually 50 under 50% of the median contribution to public health. And for comparison, talking about, you know, excise taxes, I could get back to you with the exact figures, but we are significantly lower than our neighbors to the north, south, and east. So we are a unique pocket in the Northwest of very low state contributions to public health. So what that means is that the majority of our funding for public health at the local level is coming from either federal dollars or county general funds. So for our folks, we would see this as a really big win. As an option, another tool in the toolbox, if you will, to look at how we can help offset those public health costs at the local level. And sort of a twofold process, right? One is we know that raising the price is a deterrent to smoking, so it is part of our tobacco cessation and prevention efforts. Hopefully reduces some of the need for public health funding on that front of costs due to tobacco use. And then also gives us additional revenue that can be put into public health purposes. Senator Boquist, to your point, or question rather, the bill obviously doesn't specify what these dollars would go toward. I can say that our commissioners have a deep commitment to public health funding. In fact, we, you know, at state level cigarette tax support bills that would specifically direct increases to public health. So I think, again, it is a local county decision. I would expect to see a number of folks putting funding into public health directly. If nothing else, it does help balance. You know, if you can put some additional funds into public health from another source, that frees up some money for other areas of the budget as well. If folks wanted to have a conversation about specific use of the dollars, I think counties would be open to sitting at the table to discuss that as well. So for us, again, it's really the twofold. It is a mechanism to reduce tobacco use. It helps free up some revenue that we could put into public health or other areas. I would say I don't see this as an issue that only impacts our larger counties. I think we've seen in a number of areas, it's a lot of our smaller counties and some of our timber counties that have struggled the most with their budget areas. No one has a crystal ball, but Douglas County is the one county that at this point has said they would like to relinquish their public health authority, largely as a budget decision, right? They felt like it was untenable for them to continue funding public health with the lack of funds coming in from the state. I can't guarantee that this local option would have prevented that discussion, but it at least would have been another option to consider before having that conversation about simply handing services back to the state level. So I think those are the pieces that, you know, that we would be looking at in this bill of, it does give some of our smaller communities the option to consider whether a tax is appropriate for their community and to meet some of their local needs. I've also submitted written testimony from Commissioner Bill Hall of Lincoln County, who couldn't be here in person today. But thank you. Happy to answer any questions if I can.
All right. Let's go to Mr. Smith and then take questions.
Morning, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, Andy Smith for the City of Portland. I just wanted to briefly express the city's support for this bill for all the reasons that you heard from Senator Monroe and our local government partners. So we support the bill, and we thank Senator Monroe for bringing it forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Burcham.
Just one question, just a thought. But if a city or a county raised the taxes on cigarettes, or tobacco products, wouldn't people start buying them outside of that jurisdiction? And that would just null and void the whole philosophy of raising money if they just went outside the jurisdiction and bought the cigarettes and brought them back in.
Senator Richiger, Chair Haas, again, not having a crystal ball, I think there's the potential for that. I also think the logistics make that unlikely to happen in all cases. As Tricia Tillman mentioned, a number of folks who are likely to begin smoking are some of our lower-income communities. Transportation is often an issue there. Is someone going to catch a bus to get into Washington County from Multnomah County because cigarettes are cheaper there? When getting to the bus is already an issue, I don't know. In some of our smaller rural counties, it may be, a couple hours to the county line. Maybe if you're in a larger county doing your shopping anyway, you'd pick up your cigarettes there, but I don't know that you'd make the two-hour trek to, the mini mart in Lake County versus Harney County to get cheaper cigarettes. So there is the potential, but I don't know how high the likelihood is. I think there are other challenges to that.
Senator Bertschinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think your analogy is incorrect. I mean, I think currently right now, a lot of folks from Washington travel to Oregon to buy cigarettes, maybe in the neighborhood of 38 million packs a year. So I think that I would investigate that to make sure that you're accurate on your observations. Thank you.
Thank you both.
At $2 a pack, I don't blame them.
I would call up a team from Platts, Jonathan Polanski, Mark Conan, and Mark Grable. You guys want to come up together?
Chairman Haas, Vice Chair Boquist, committee members. My name is Jonathan Polanski. I'm the COO for Plaid Pantry. We own and operate 108 convenience stores, which employs about 750 people. Most of those folks are in the Portland metro area. We're also the founding member, or a founding member, of the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association, and we strongly oppose Senate Bill 14. Such a measure would be devastating to many small Oregon businesses, but it will also be very devastating to state finances, as well as the Oregon Health Plan. Why? Because every dollar raised by local governments will be newfound money for them. They will have no responsibility for the effects of state finances, the Oregon Health Plan, or Oregon small businesses. There will likely be a strong incentive for local governments to tax at high rates versus taking a more moderate approach. The taxes raised from the sale of cigarettes is substantial, but it's also relatively fragile and it's also declining. The state legislature is currently the steward of this resource, and it should remain that way. Just like a retirement account, the amount of income that you get from that account and the duration of that income is directly correlated to the size of the account. Allowing local governments to make big withdrawals, in this case in the form of large tax increases, will have long-term negative consequences. It will decrease the amount of cigarettes sold that the state is counting on to continue to generate income for many more years, and it will reduce the long-term revenue available. The state should remain the sole taxing authority of all tobacco products. Only you can determine the proper balance among all the competing needs for these declining dollars, as well as consider the adverse impacts on Oregon's overall economy. Thank you. Mark.
Chairman Haas.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Committee members, my name is Mark Cohen, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Plaid Pantries. In our written testimony, we included a fiscal year 2016 projection modeling a $1 per pack local cigarette tax in the major populated counties. When you look at the attached graphs for details, you'll see that the assumed tax results in about a 50 million pack decrease in Oregon tax cigarettes over 2 years, almost one-third of the base. This loss is a result of three factors. First, Washingtonians buying less in Oregon. Second, a large increase in Oregon tobacco users avoiding the tax. And third, 2 years of the underlying base decrease in cigarette usage. At the 2016 Oregon excise tax rate of $1.32 per pack, this represents a reduction in state cigarette tax revenue of about $66 million. This does not count the effect of expected local taxes on other tobacco products or the reduced unit volumes that will reduce the master settlement agreement payments coming to the state. All this takes money away from the state, most of which comes out of the Oregon Health Plan. Local tobacco taxes also represent future revenue capacity lost by the state. In addition to negative consequences for the state finances, a $1 per pack county tax would take about $400 million of sales of tobacco and related products out of tax compliant stores like ours and push it into the gray and black markets. This represents about $78 million in private business income that is currently going primarily for retail and wholesale wages and benefits. When sales go down, we'll have to decrease our labor cost. We'll do that by decreasing work hours, terminating excess employees, and reducing employee benefits. I'd like you to think about the stores on the border of Multnomah County that will become unprofitable and end up closing. This is particularly important to us because we have 56 stores of our 108 in Multnomah County and lots of competitors in Washington and Clackamas County that would potentially take those sales. This affects more than just businesses losing the $400 million in sales. Plaid Pantry alone does business with over 300 companies, mostly Oregon small businesses that supply our products, services, repairs, and maintenance. Allowing counties to levy their own tobacco taxes potentially wipes out more in state funding and private business income than they would actually raise from it. For these reasons, we oppose this bill and urge you to maintain state control over tobacco taxes. Thank you for your time and for your service, and we'd be happy to take questions now or after Mark talks.
Chairman Haas, committee members, my name is Mark Vrabel. I'm the CFO of the Portland Division of Core-Mark International. Core-Mark is a broadline distributor of supplies and services to the convenience retail industry. In this capacity, we employ approximately 200 Oregonians out of our Portland office and about another 100 Oregonians out of our Grants Pass Distribution Center. Together, the two distribution centers supply approximately 950 convenience stores. In 2014, the two divisions collected over $74 million in cigarette tax stamp revenue and another $23 million in tobacco and cigar taxes for the state of Oregon. This $97 million of the total $258 million collected represents 38% of the total revenue. Senate Bill 14 fails to designate whether or not a county tax stamp will or will not be attached to an individual cigarette package, which could inherently create a lack of enforcement from the counties and in turn create an environment that would diminish taxable revenue collection. In addition, the bill does not address jurisdiction identification on tobacco and cigar products that currently are not subject to a tax stamp and are packaged by the manufacturer in a way that is not conducive and cost prohibitive to apply a tax stamp. Multiple tax stamp jurisdictions create additional cost at the distribution level. These costs will get added to the end user, which will further reduce consumption of in-state product. If a stamp is assessed by county, the requirement to stamp multiple county jurisdictions will force distributors to stamp the product on demand as opposed to the current system of machine pre-stamping the product. This will force production costs up at least three times out of the current rate. These increased business costs will ultimately be passed to the retailer, who in turn will pass the additional cost to the end user. This will create further incentive for the end user to shop for the lowest priced product, which could very well mean shopping out of state via the internet or the black market. Inevitably, this will reduce tax revenues for the state and hurt the Oregon economy while creating a nightmare for legitimate tax-abiding distributors. Other tobacco products, such as this roll of chewing tobacco, currently do not require stamp identification. The product is packaged in a way that is not conducive to stamping, and there's currently no machinery available that can separate the product from the package, apply a tax stamp, and then reseal it. And in order to apply a stamp, this product would require the individual selling unit to be separated from the package, hand-stamped, and then banded back together for sale at wholesale level. As a consequence, the wholesale cost would rise dramatically to cover the associated cost of labor. States who have attempted to apply a tax stamp in the past on chewing tobacco have met with resistance from the manufacturers, who have stated that they will simply cease selling the product in those states rather than change their packaging for a single state. In both cases, the distributors are not equipped with machinery that can perform the tax application in an effective, low-cost manner. The addition of a county tax stamp will increase the wholesale distributor labor costs and ultimately reduce the tax revenues for the state and hurt the Oregon economy while putting more strain on legitimate tax-abiding distributors and wholesalers. For the reasons above, we strongly oppose relinquishing the state's sole taxing authority on cigarettes and tobacco products to cities, counties, or other municipal entities. Thank you.
Thank you. Could I read between the lines and say that to you, a state tax increase on tobacco is preferable to letting counties and cities do it on their own?
From a distributor standpoint, if there was going to be a tax increase, it would definitely be better at the state level, just for logistic purposes.
Flat pantry.
Again, back to the kind of the retirement account analogy, I mean, any increase because of this disparity is going to lower, obviously, the amount of product sold. So obviously, I can't sit here and say we're for a tax increase, but if there is one or has to be one, to Mark's point, I mean, it's going to create the whole patchwork thing, I think a couple other folks testified to, is a nightmare on a lot of levels.
So Chairman Hass, if I could answer the question, I mean, or just add on to
absolutely.
It is less bad, if that's fair,
okay,
for us.
Do you have stores in Washington State?
Yes, we do.
Okay. The tobacco tax there, as you know, is $2 higher than Oregon's per pack. And you're still open in those stores.
Those
stores are still open and operating. Is there a correlation in sales? Do you notice that? Or
I can take it. Yeah. Chairman Hass. Very much so. As a matter of fact, we're the beneficiary of that because we have more stores on the Oregon side. We have 2 stores in Vancouver and 56 stores in Multnomah County. Specifically, our Jansen Beach store, between 2009 and 2011, there was a big Washington increase in 2010. Our sales there tripled. That's our closest border store. Mm-hmm. Our Airport Way store is similar. So we're a net beneficiary, as is the state, because of all the Washingtonians buying there.
Right. Okay. Senator Bertschinger.
I guess this would be for Mark at Cormart. Could you explain to the committee the logistics on how the state collects the tax and what role your company plays in that? I don't think the committee knows exactly how.
Are you talking cigarette tax?
Yeah, the cigarette tax.
With the cigarette tax, we purchase our state tax stamps in advance and apply them to the packs. So at that point, we're collecting the revenue and paying the revenue when we buy the tax stamps. I file a quarterly reconciliation report that details our sales and shipments out of state, but for all intents and purposes, it's collected when we purchase the tax stamp.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Is Michael Tynan here?
Yeah, can I ask a question to him? I usually say,
sir, thanks. I know you don't have a presentation prepared and you
right.
didn't sign up, but I do have some questions here. You did some work with the CDC and analyzed the impact of tobacco taxes on health, and I was just wondering if you have any reoccurring themes that have proven out in research and actual use across the country.
Sure. So for the record, my name is Michael Tynan. I'm the policy director for the Oregon Health Authority Public Health Division, and as Senator Haas mentioned, previously, I worked at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta in the Office on Smoking and Health, and I worked on cigarette taxes and smoke-free laws. As Tricia Tillman from Multnomah County said, cigarette tax increases are the most effective tool that we have to prevent tobacco use in the United States and in the world. This is not a new concept, the idea of raising cigarette taxes when in the 1700s, the idea by economists of raising cigarette taxes to generate revenue for governments is an idea that was presented in Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith, who was an economist. So this is not a new concept by any means. Some of the statements today, though, about cross-border sales and smuggling are, based on the research that I'm aware of, a little bit overstated. Based on the studies that I have experience with, less than 1% of all cigarette sales are related to informal cross-border or smuggling activities. And so this can actually be bared out with the fact that 2/3 of all smokers purchase their cigarettes by a single pack, even though it's more advantageous for smokers to say, for example, buy by the carton because you get a substantial discount by buying by the carton. 2/3 of smokers buy by the single pack because every smoker thinks that the pack that they're buying is the last pack that they are going to buy. And the idea that smokers would change their habits to cross borders, to cross county borders, doesn't bear out. Smokers go back to their original patterns, and they go back to the convenience store where they've been typically buying because they think that last pack that they bought will indeed be the last pack that they buy. It takes a smoker somewhere between 8 and 10 quit attempts to quit smoking over the lifetime, and many smokers want to quit, and most smokers make at least one quit attempt a year. So we have numerous evidence also from other states that have raised local cigarette taxes. There's numerous examples from Alaska, for example, who has the authority to raise cigarette taxes at the local level. And it's not just large communities. There's small communities in Alaska like Bethel, which is a community of 6,000 people, which has raised the cigarette tax and has been effective in raising the local cigarette tax. New York City is probably the best example we have of a community with strong data. New York City smoking rates in the early 2000s were 22%, which is about what the national average was at the time. And after a comprehensive effort of raising cigarette taxes, using those funds on local prevention campaigns, everything from running mass media campaigns to funding local prevention activities, they saw smoking rates decline from 21.6% in 2002 to 14% in 2010. That represents 350,000 people who quit smoking. That's about as many smokers as we have in the state of Oregon.
New York's cigarette tax is $4.52 per pack.
Correct. They're the second highest in the country when you combine the state and local tax. And that's an indicator that local taxes work. And what I gave you was the adult numbers. Youth smoking in New York City is about 7%. That's a phenomenal number. If we were able to get our youth smoking down to 7%, it would be a public health success that people would talk about nationally.
Are you saying higher cost trumps advertising in terms of convincing people that
Well, of course, a comprehensive program is the most effective tool, but increasing the price is the most effective thing that we have in the toolbox for public health. For every 10% you raise the price of tobacco, you see a reduction of consumption by 4%, and it's twice to three times as effective among youth. And these studies have been replicated nationally and internationally that show that these changes. These aren't just examples from states in the United States or in the United States, but internationally. We see this indicator of a 10% increase in price results in a 4% reduction in consumption.
And finally, do you have any data on the merits of a state letting local governments raise?
We can get you data on what's happened in communities that have done it. Like I said, Alaska is one of the states that comes to mind for me with the most communities that have raised the cigarette taxes. There are other examples of New York City and Chicago and large communities that have done it. But as far as a state that does not have preemption and just allows local communities to raise the tax, Alaska is probably the best example we have, and we can get you that data.
Senator Riley.
Thank you. Do you have any data or research that shows we've been talking a lot about revenue and how much revenue we're going to lose. Do you have any thoughts about how much the costs of health care will go down in the state if we do this?
Those estimates can be done. I don't have them off the top of my head, but there are, for example, ways that we could estimate, for example, a dollar increase in the tax will result in this many fewer smokers, this many pregnant women who would quit, who would smoke, the cost that would be reduced for the Medicaid program, et cetera. Those estimates can be reproduced.
Could you do that for this committee, please?
We could do that, yes.
Thank you.
So just for clarification, he's with the Oregon Health Authority? I would just follow up with a comment. We actually have more experience than I think you know in regards to cigarette smuggling, cross-border things, so on and so forth. This legislature spent over $30 million in two bienniums tracking and trying to figure out what to do it. And I would suggest the director of the Oregon Health Authority maybe cross a little information over and find out what we've done instead of saying we don't know what we're talking about.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
Appreciate you coming up
on
a moment's notice and without a presentation.
No problem.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sean Miller. And Richard Kosis here. I'll make you the last panel because we have people who have come for the next bill that we need to get to.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association in opposition to Senate Bill 14. And, you know, it's interesting as I hear the debate on this, and this issue has been around for several sessions, is this push and, you know, pull debate. It seems like you can talk out of both sides of your mouth when you're dealing with the impacts of smoking cessation when you raise the cost, which I'm not here to argue against. You know, as you layer on above the state tobacco tax, county and even city taxes like they do in Alaska, you are going to see a reduction in revenue, not only from the state, but a reduction in some of those areas as they adjust their local taxes. And so, but in several sessions, counties have come in and actually have argued in front of this committee that they want the ability to raise revenue for their counties, their cities, and so to use this as a revenue source. And it's very difficult to do both. I think it's a policy discussion that you all have to wrestle with within this bill is, you know, how do you argue and come in and ask for our new revenue source when we know that increase in the arguments that from the prior speakers that it is a smoking cessation, you know, and lowers that the number of smokers. And so, you know, Alaska is an example that does allow this in many jurisdictions, their boroughs and their cities. And, you know, just looking into it from what I've done, you know, Alaska, because of that, has had to then shift their focus on the revenue source to other more reliable revenue sources because of that. Because of the reductions in revenue over time with their policy. So, you know, again, I just want to caution the committee and my organization that I represent, just a preemption in general. You know, whether we agree or disagree on different policy issues, we would much rather be addressing these issues in front of the legislature on a statewide basis versus local a local by local and a patchwork approach across the state. I know, Mr. Chair, you know, there's several preemption issues that are, you know, always involved in this session, whether it's this issue, you know, lifting the preemption on minimum wage. In the past, the business community has come in and talked about preemption of other issues, including this session involving sick leave. You know, again, the business community is looking for, you know, predictability within the state, and again, these we feel whether we agree or disagree on different policy issues, we want to at least have that argument on a statewide approach. And so, with that, I'll just conclude my remarks and happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay, Richard Kosasan.
Chairman Hass, members of the committee, Richard Kosasan with the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association, and I will be very brief, but I'd like to make just a couple of comments. One, Senate Bill 14 doesn't deal with county ability, but it deals with county and municipal ability. Giving cities the ability to tax tobacco, whether it be a pack of cigarettes or other tobacco products as we know them. In terms of a pack of cigarettes, stamping currently, I think, is fairly accurate. But to place a state tax or a state tax stamp, a city stamp, a county tax, and an additional stamp for every city and county is basically an enforcement impossibility. But looking at some actual numbers in terms of cross-border sales, let's compare the 13-14 fiscal year with Oregon and Washington. And if one were to look at the per capita consumption between those two states, Oregon's per capita consumption in that year was 41.4 packs per capita. Washington was 18.6. If you would blend those two, you would come up to a per capita rate of about 30 packs per capita. If you would apply that to Oregon, that would, at 30 packs per capita, represent a loss of about 44 million packs. I think if you take a hard look at your counties in Multnomah County, Columbia County, Umatilla County, Hood River County, Sherman County, you will find that there is a tremendous degree of cross-border sales. In terms of the retail community, with a tax applied to one retail operation on one side of the street, and their nearest competitor is down the street but happens to be in a different jurisdiction, with a substantial tax, you basically put one retail establishment out of business and you create a windfall for the other retail establishment. I think the tax should be uniform throughout the state. I think the enforcement works today, and changing that, I think, creates some untold problems for the state, specifically with respect to the loss of revenue to the Oregon Health Plan. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions to these two men? Thank you. All right, we're going to have to cut it off there because we have another bill we have to get to, and we will hear more on this issue. So I'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 14. And we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 516. Kyle, is this your issue? And where we last left this was to get more of an analysis from the Housing Community Services Agency to look at the inflows and outflows of funds. And they have done their homework, completed their assignment, and are back before us. Did you want to come up to you? Okay.
You're getting thrown under the bus, it looks like.
Not at all. She's got my back.
Do we want to do a brief overview of what the bill does, Kyle?
Yeah, I can hit on it real quickly. Sure. Mike. So just as a reminder, Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 516, we heard this a week ago, last Thursday, and it relates to a document recording fee of $20 that goes to the Oregon Housing Department. $5 of which is dedicated to veterans housing programs, and the remaining $15 is dedicated based on a formula that's in law and everything. And as you said, there were a few questions the committee had last week that were related to the housing, how the money is spent, and if there's the money's been swept or anything along those lines. So we have with us the director of the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department, Margaret Van Vliet, to hopefully address those questions.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, my name is Margaret Van Vliet. I am the director of Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. I'm aware of the important questions that this committee asked about document recording fee last week. So today I'm going to do my very best job to try and answer those questions for you. And so we've got quite a bit of information that I believe is in OLIS and is on this PowerPoint presentation. As you've heard, the document recording fee came into existence in 2009. It added the $15 fee to recording of real property documents at the county level to fund affordable housing. In 2013, the additional $5 was added specifically to provide housing resources for veterans. As you've heard, by statute, the fee is divided into three major purposes. And today I'm going to go through each of those programmatically and financially and give you a status update. In broad terms, since its inception, we have received $58 million in document recording fee. So this slide shows, against that $58 million and the three different categories, how much has been expended. And clearly, there's a very large amount, a total of $27 million, that has not been expended. And so I want to walk you through kind of what's behind those numbers. What I would say to you is that there are some sort of very reasonable pieces attached to that. For example, approximately $5 million has been reserved for specific projects, but they're in construction or they haven't started construction, and so those funds haven't been drawn out. There's another $3 million that is accumulating specifically to provide rental housing for veterans. That's sort of sitting in that account. But the other thing I would say to you is that this agency probably hasn't been as aggressive as we could be in really getting these dollars out the door as quickly as they should be. I'm very committed to turning that around. We've had some changes in policies and some leadership in the last couple of years. I do feel confident that we've got the capacity to do a better job here, and I'm going to walk you through our plan for this year that should get us there. There were some questions about how much admin fee the agency is taking, and here are the broad sort of percentages. 10% for the biggest account is a pretty large number, and what I would share with you is that that represents some upfront costs in getting the programs positioned to go out the door to our partners. I fully expect that number to reduce as we, in fact, send more money out the door for development. So what I'm going to do is walk you through the three major buckets, and starting with this first one, which is called the General Housing Account. It is specifically for multifamily housing development. 76% of all of the fees do go into this account. It is blended with several other sources of public funds, and I should say also private sector funds. And as a result, and I think you heard some of this last week, it's blended into very complicated real estate financing packages. And so that's part of the story of how these resources get used. The process we use is we blend these package different resources that are in our agency and offer them competitively to community-based and private sector developers. And they're the ones who develop, own, and manage the real estate that's affordable housing. For this current year, we plan 7 distinct NOFAs, and we believe we'll be able to distribute all the money that's in this general housing account. And I do want to stress that for my agency, our role is to be something of the public bank. We do not do development directly. We do not do real estate development directly. We provide the financing to others. And because some of the federal funds that we administer do require competitions, and because there is so much need, we've been refining our competitive processes. So here's just a quick kind of overview of the major sources of funds that my agency administers. These are the ones that get blended, packaged, and offered to community groups and the development community to provide the housing. All of these come with very stringent rules and regulations. They're complicated to use. They're complicated to administer. And so, again, we've been working to refine our processes. And I'll give you a little bit more detail about what's behind some of these here in a minute. I also want to stress that there are many local governments who invest their own resources in affordable housing as well as these ones that we do at the state level. So as I mentioned, in the last couple of years, for a variety of reasons, we've been working to refine and improve our competitive funding processes connected specifically to multifamily rental housing. This idea of blending the resources is important. It's, again, complicated work. And so what we've got to do is do that, try our very best to stay current and do that efficiently and effectively. We package and tailor the offerings for different kinds of projects. For example, larger rental properties would use certain kinds of tax credits and smaller ones would not. There's a particular set of initiatives around preservation of affordable rental housing that has federal rent assistance subsidies. That takes a different flavor of money. Veterans, we think we need to do it in a particular way. And then mobile home park preservation and financing is its own sort of unique animal. So when you think about the real estate aspects and the nature of the money and the color of the money, this is where it gets sort of tricky. But that's what we're working on. The other point we've been focused on in terms of this competition and all of our competitions is we're trying very hard to assess community need, and you heard a little bit about the vast need for more affordable housing last week. So what we want to do is get as savvy as we can and be clear about investing our public resources where there is the most need and where those projects will have the best community impact and the best best long-term outcomes for the residents. That's often very qualitative and hard to assess, but we think it's important that we try to make sure we're leveraging and achieving good public policy outcomes. We have also, in the last couple of years, begun using external scoring committees so that it is not just state agency folks who are rating and ranking the winners and non-winners in our competitions. And I should mention that we also have oversight and policy advice by the Oregon State Housing Council. As a sidebar, I would share with you that this Oregon State Housing Council, we believe, is well positioned to provide oversight and policy advice. There is a bill working its way through session. It's House Bill 2442, which would change and give, I would say, more authority to this council. And we intend to lean very heavily on them and their expertise to help us do this work well. So we do have some sort of accountability and transparency elements we're working very hard to reinforce. We know, for example, that geographic targeting is very important, certainly to many members, but also to our communities. And so we've built in geographic targets based on population and severity of rent burden and things of that nature. We're also working to make sure that when we make selections about which projects to fund, that we do so with an eye towards what are local and regional priorities. There are regional solutions teams and coordinated care organizations and early learning hubs and all sorts of local and regional collaboratives that are working very hard at assessing local needs and priorities. We want to make sure that we tie into that good work and that our sponsors also tie into that good work. This is a look at all of the dollars we expect to put out through these competitions. We call them Notices of Funds Availability, or NOFAs, this year. Now, a couple of these are already on the street, and the rest will be out later this spring. And so this is a list of all of the resources, and you can see their underlying source, whether it's federal or state. And what we're doing is blending, taking a little of this and a little of that, and putting that out in a NOFA, for example, for veterans, and a little of this and a little of that out for manufactured park preservation. And so all of these are, you know, it's big dollars that we're charged with administering, and it's incumbent on us to do that as well as we possibly can. I want to show you geographically where our resources have gone on this multifamily side. This is a five-year look back just at this document recording fee, or general housing account program fee, where there have been projects funded throughout the state. You see it's about 2,500 units and 66 different projects have received this money. That covers 22 counties. We've also done about $2.5 million in capacity building, and this is important because capacity is very different in different parts of the state. And so part of the document recording fee is specifically targeted to build capacity for housing development. And here is that data just numerically, so you can see on the multifamily side, the general housing account program side of document recording fee, where those funds have gone so far. And there are certainly counties that haven't gotten any yet, but I'll show you another slide that shows more even distribution. So this picture and the next slide will show you not just document recording fee, but all those multifamily resources that we administer, tax credits and other state sources, and where all of that money over 5 years has gone. Just almost 8,000 units in over 200 properties, covering 31 counties. And again, numerically, you can see sort of how that all looks. And we're working really hard to have data like this readily available just for our own kind of management purposes, but also so that we can share it with the State Housing Council, with the legislature, and members of the public. This slide shows the total numbers by year of all these multifamily resources that I'm talking about. The other point I want to make here is the degree to which tax credits actually are used by private investors. And so when we're administering tax credits, they're purchased by a corporation or a bank that has, tax obligations, and they bring in substantial equity. So I believe this number may actually be a little bit conservative, but, $500 million leveraged by these resources. So there is a very substantial private sector leveraging that goes on with this multifamily development work. So the piece of the general housing account that is specifically set aside for veterans, we have not spent this yet. We have accumulated just under $3 million and will be offering $3 million this spring. We've worked closely with partners to try and figure out what's the best way to provide this money on the street so that it really does house veterans. We leaned heavily on a rules advisory committee, and we're going to actually forward allocate a piece of what we expect to come this year so that we're getting ahead of this distribution question. So now I'm going to shift away from that big general housing account and talk about the emergency housing account. This is where a much smaller portion of document recording fee goes. It's 10% overall. It's used for these purposes that you see here, really around preventing and ending homelessness. Our delivery system for this part of the money is community action agencies. They are delivery partners for these resources and a variety of others. They get their funds not based on a competition, rather, but by formula. And there's a formula that's agreed on that looks at housing burden, poverty statistics, and the number of homeless people in their communities. There are 17 community action agencies, if you're not familiar with them, that cover all 36 Oregon counties. And here is a look at where the emergency housing account has gone out through these community action agencies. The bulk of it you can see there, the $4.8 million is this piece I was just describing. There are a couple of smaller pieces that don't go through CAPS. One of them is, by agreement with the CAPS, goes to the Rural Oregon Continuum of Care, which is an organizing body that specifically works on rural homelessness. So they've taken a small piece by agreement. There are a couple of other organizations who have done similar sort of statewide safety net related work. And so they've gotten a small piece as well. But in general, you can sort of see how the geographic distribution looks on that. And these figures that I'm showing on this slide do include the veterans piece of the emergency housing account. And again, it's 25% of this account. Community Action, the agencies are agent. They are working hard to form relationships with the county veteran service officers. Many of them have already been doing that very naturally. But I think with the advent of these funds, we're really stressing that we need to make sure that if a veteran walks in their door or through outreach they come across a veteran, that they provide that linkage at the local level and that these resources are leveraged in that way. And we're committed to working with our colleagues in state government to shore that system up to whatever degree it needs. And I think with a little more experience under our belt, we'll know if that's working. Thank you. And so then the third and final account is the homeownership assistance account. This is where 14% of the document recording fee goes. It does a variety of work connected to first-time homeownership and some in helping folks retain homeownership in the wake of the foreclosure crisis. There's statutory language that asks us to look at trying to close the minority homeownership gap. Our delivery system for these sources is mostly through housing centers. These locally based, regionally based housing centers provide education, pre-purchase counseling, assistance with down payment assistance, and a variety of other sort of homeownership related pieces. I want to share one success story out of this pot of money. Yamhill Community Action Agency applied for and received some of what we call innovation funds out of this bucket. They started a highly successful aging in place program and helped to do sort of health and safety repairs for low-income elderly homeowners that helped them stay in their homes. One success story is a woman who had her bedroom door widened so she could get her wheelchair inside her bedroom. And so I think that's a good retention story. And that was a use because these funds are flexible and some of them are designed to provide innovation. This community partner was able to provide a very needed service. This sort of dot map just shows, again, graphically where this aspect of the document recording fee has gone, and the dot equals $2,000, and I'm not sure what the significance of that is, but you can generally see the density, and there's data behind that if anybody wants it. What I would point out in the Harney and Malheur counties, they have not yet received any of this money. There's a couple of pieces behind that that I want to call to your attention. They're served actually by a fairly new community action agency that's called Community in Action. They do receive other resources from my agencies, specifically around homeownership. And they also receive HUD funds to do a variety of homeownership related work. They recently became HUD certified, and as a result of that, they're now eligible for this piece of the document recording fee. So it looks it's a glaring sort of white part on the map, and I just wanted to reassure you that we're working with them to make sure that they also benefit from this. They certainly get other resources from the agency, but just hadn't gotten this yet. The veterans piece of the homeownership work, we have worked closely with the Oregon Department of Vets to think about how we could marry this program with their vets loan program to do things like down payment assistance, home repair and modification. Of course, we're finding that that's an increasingly important thing for veterans. And then sometimes mortgage payment assistance is a need for returning vets if they own a home already and they need some time to restabilize their homeownership situation. And so we're moving forward with them. We have not implemented this yet, but we're very close. It required some rule changes and a couple of other things. So that's in process. So overall, this is the map of where all the document recording fee funds have gone so far, and you can see the dollar amounts at the bottom against the sort of the total that's been expended. And there's data behind this, of course, that we can show you in more detail if that would be useful to any committee members. This, I know, was a question that's really at the heart of the bill. So the question is about how much revenue have we received versus how much has gone back to those regions. And so the regions are the same as what this map shows. And you can see there that in Central, the blue bar, the one on the left, is what they have gotten back through my agency, compared to their percentage of the state population. And then the gray bar is the percentage of total document recording fee they've contributed to the overall pot. So in Central and Metro, there is a mismatch. In the rest of the state, it's not. It's a different story. I do believe that with the work we're doing this year to really get more drive more aggressively to get the funds out, that some of this will even out. I think it is an important question, and so I hope this is a helpful representation.
Thank you. It is helpful, and you're right. These last two slides are the heart of the matter here.
Right.
And when I look there, I see there's two disparities, Metro and Northeast.
Correct.
And I can see why the Central Oregon folks feel, mm-hmm. you know, a little bit put out.
Absolutely.
If they look next door and look at the mm-hmm. metro area mm-hmm. and the,
exactly.
you know, quote-unquote inequality there,
right.
They have nothing to complain about. And so, I don't know, I think, you know, ideally in a perfect world, all of those levels would be at the same height.
Right, right. And over time, my guess is that they will ebb and flow. I think everybody having access to the data when they want it is important, and I think you need to hear me say that I'm very committed to making sure this data is current, available for everybody's view, and we can have good conversations about, you know, what's behind the data, and are there things that we're missing? So we're very committed to making sure you and all our community partners have this information, and we haven't done as good a job of that in the past as we should have. So,
when you look at those winners and losers there, I can see how it mm-hmm. works like that, but it does look like the percentage-wise, Northeast is way out of whack.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any reason for that, or just the dynamics of, are they good at winning those competitive bids, or what? I mean,
yeah, Mr. Chair, it may be that they've won a couple of projects that boosted the number, and if we could unpack that and sort of look at what's behind that, what, you know, and where are those projects? I think there's a, you know, the map that shows. I'm going to go out on a limb here. So it may be, so there's a couple of projects you can see in the Northeast quadrant there that probably were highly competitive projects that came in and scored well and got a bigger chunk. Again, I think because we have so much that's going to go out on the street this year, all this data could look pretty different even just a year from now.
Senator Boquist?
I think, first of all, I thank the director for coming back to the committee and taking the Truman position, which is the buck stops here. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things that jumps out at me across the board, and I think we all have to remember, is that at least 25% of this, which is the veterans document fee, only kicked in 2014. And so we have this big chunk of change coming in. The biggest concern I have that jumps out, Mr. Chair, and kind of for the record, and the director and I have talked this, is that, you know, when you have 25, 28, 30 million, or before, as this is growing, when we hit a downturn, the first place you look to sweep money out is these accounts. And there's a very fine line that the department has to pick up the pace and start delivering more funds to those people that need these services so that we don't have a huge pot sitting there, one, that's sweepable, and two, that we actually get the services that are out there a lot more. The formularies, I think, are something that we're going to have to go back and review and probably other policy committees in the future, because we just don't have the information. And I think what you see here is, if you look on the far right there, and correct me wrong, Madam Director, if I'm wrong, you have, if you're doing general family housing, the cost model, as we heard before, is 40 to 60 units. You really can't get below that. you can use preservation dollars to preserve something that's out there and rebuild it. But if you have a 40 to 60 unit out there, you know, in the Northeast, there's this big chunk that goes out there because that's just the bottom line of economics. You can build one of these. And that's the problem, I think, with the formula is that could address some of the issues that were even brought up in 516, and that is the deal of not all counties are equal. You can't build a 40 to 60 unit down there in Malheur County because there isn't down there, whereas maybe the formula needs to be adjusted to say, hey, we need more emergency housing money down here, because we just did it, if you remember, we did this at Swoops. You get 10, you get... Actually, you get 76, you get 10, you get 14, and 25% goes to veterans. And that doesn't work in Malheur County because they're never going to be able to build anything out of the general housing account. And you see that disparity there, which is probably a larger unit. And so going back and figuring out as we gain expertise at the agency and tasking the agency to say, how are we doing this? Because some of these, you know, the emergency housing account might need to be really higher in one area versus what we're really allocating it and lower in another area. And the only other comment I would make to warn the agency is the county veteran service officer is really the way to go. I would steer shy presently of the Veterans Administration home loan program, and the reason being with that, it's good to do work with them, but what we found in the other committees is that because interest rates are dirt cheap right now, is that nobody's getting veterans home loans because they're more expensive because we use bonding authority at the state, and so we had a layer on. But I do want to thank the director for you know, saying the buck stops here, but we certainly have to move faster because if they don't sweep the money in the next downturn, they're coming to this committee for a tax increase. So, and that is a risk. We see that in 911. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Thank you for that thorough explanation. And, you know, we all, like you, would want to even up those lines, although Northeast Oregon would probably be happy if you just kept it the way it is. But I think it, in terms of fairness, and we all probably would acknowledge that there's just not enough money overall to meet the needs, but fairness from Central Oregon to Metro to Northeast is a high priority.
Right. Got it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, nobody else has signed up to discuss this bill, and we have no other business before us, so we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 16. And the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee will adjourn. Senate Finance and Revenue Committee will adjourn. Senate Finance.